I was recently visiting with some friends, listening to, absorbing their experiences of what it is like to work in human resources for medium and large-sized corporations. Listening to what it is like to be called the Terminator by your family. Because it is your job to have to terminate someone else's. What it is like to witness, person to person, the pain and the fear of others on a regular basis. You may remember the film Up in the Air, the one where George Clooney plays the transition consultant, whose job it is to fly in and fire employees of other companies as efficiently and as smoothly as possible. Well, that film may have exaggerated some of the elements of the job, but the relentless undercurrent of dis-ease, for some of these folks, that film can be hard to watch, because it hits so close to home. To be clear, these are both good people, compassionate people who entered this work hoping to match people's passions and skill sets with organizations in need of their gifts, hoping to live a vocation along the lines of Frederick Buechner's classic description of God calling us to the place where our deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. And yet, year by year, what they have encountered are corporations more and more fearful of risk and desperate for return. And that slowly the distorting and deforming currents of impersonal and insatiable market forces have pulled my friends further and further and further away from where they entered the water. Or to use another metaphor, month by month, encounter by encounter, they have borne the brunt of the burdens for corporations beholden to shareholders and bound to the market's relentless expectation of growth. And so I find it to be not a coincidence at all that one of my friends carries her wallet and keys in a small bag that is inscribed with two simple words: be free. Be free. Now, these words also signify the remarkable truth that in a few weeks' time, she is to be married to her longtime partner. For much of her life, she hasn't been free to tell the world of her love, let alone to have it be recognized. But it was in hearing her stories of fundamental cognitive dissonance, of feeling forced to participate in a culture and in a structure that clearly and consistently values profit margin over living, breathing human beings. It was in hearing her stories that I understood the words on her bag to be more than a general statement and more of a personal demand for integrity. In a culture which has slowly but surely bound her, she simply wants to be free. What must it be like, bent over at the waist for years, unable to stand up straight? First off, what would you see? What would you see? So far as I can imagine, it would be nothing more than a patch of ground immediately at your feet. It would be impossible to see who is coming toward you, friend or foe. When you are bent over in this way, your world diminishes, literally and figuratively. Now, it's not clear from our vantage point, a couple of thousand of years removed, what this woman's ailment was. What we are told in this text is that she had been suffering for 18 years, but the words in the Greek used to describe this crippling affliction are curious. Curious because the words for illness in this text simply refer to an inability to stand up straight. And more curious still, the words Jesus uses to describe her suffering at the end of this passage are most often used in references to chains and shackles in Greek, right? Of an animal being bound by force, not of a physical malady for a person. And the phrase associated with his healing action, "You are set free," it doesn't follow any pattern of healing we see in other encounters. The Greek words here used are used when one unties a donkey or sets someone free from bondage, not typical to an illness or a healing. Now, this is not to diminish the pain of this woman, only to recognize that for Jesus, it seems to be indicative of a suffering that is more than simply physical. In this story, the woman's physical stature stands in for all sorts of forces of burden and binding. And so it is no coincidence that the writer of Luke's gospel frames this action that Jesus takes within the context of the Sabbath. Now, Jesus has these confrontations all the time, it seems, 6 of them in this gospel alone, and 4 of them involving healing on the Sabbath. Each time he does something like this, the foundational command to keep the Sabbath and to keep it holy is at tension. To be clear, there were several interpretations about the Sabbath held by faithful Jews like Jesus at this time. And some of them allowed for acts of mercy. In this passage, though, Jesus seems to be contradicting one of the more restrictive interpretations. But why? Clearly, this was not an emergent situation. This woman had been suffering for 18 years, we are told. But it is when we listen to the words that Jesus uses as he heals her that it becomes evident that this wasn't so much about religious observance as it was about restrictive social order. Again, verse 12. When Jesus saw her, he called her over and said, "Woman, you are set free from your ailment." Now, at this point, we need to remember that there are actually 2 versions of the 10 Commandments, or the Decalogue, in the Bible. Pop quiz. What books are they found in? The Bible. Yes. Good. Good. Excellent. I think I heard in Exodus and Deuteronomy. Right? So, in the book of Exodus, the reason for keeping the Sabbath is that God rested on the final act of creation, the final day, and thereby blesses the Sabbath for us. The second iteration of the 10 Commandments, however, in Deuteronomy, the Sabbath is explained differently. Rather than being about creation, the Sabbath is about the Exodus event itself. This time, the commandment reads, "Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day." Why does this matter? Well, now this act, this healing act, this setting free on the Sabbath has a different purpose. Instead of simply being about healing, it can also be seen as a sign of freedom of release. It serves as a clear reminder of what God's desire is for God's people. Remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and God set you free. Therefore, your behavior should reflect that thirst for freedom. And not just for you, but anyone connected to you, be it livestock or resident alien. Ought not this woman, this daughter of Abraham, whom Satan bound for 18 long years, be set free from this bondage on this Sabbath day? It is not simply about being free from your oppression. It is also about using your freedom for others. As we are learning over and over again in the tumult following the Arab Spring, it is one thing to overthrow an oppressor. It is quite another to take the risks necessary to find and hold a common ground with those with whom you have serious disagreement. In another setting, that of marriage, Madeline L'Engle had this to say about the freedom for love. To marry is the biggest risk in human relations that a person can take. If we commit ourselves to one person for life, there is not, as many people think, a rejection of freedom. Rather, it demands the courage to move into all the risks of freedom and the risk of love that is permanent, into that love which is not possession, but is participation. 50 years ago this week, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was one of a 250,000 Americans standing before the Lincoln Memorial, having marched in search of freedom. Viewing from this point in our history, it can be far too easy to see the astounding success of this action and believe that success was assured. In fact, this was far from the case. The speech which Martin King delivered wasn't worked through until dawn of the day he delivered it, and the most memorable parts were improvised in the moment. For the organizers of the march, there were scores of trials that nearly derailed that day. Many white folks throughout the Washington, D.C. area were sure that the March on Washington would devolve into riots. Indeed, lawyers in the Kennedy administration had already written up martial law orders just in case. And yet, what transpired that steamy August day can now be recognized as one of the pivotal moments of these United States. What could have been dismissed as a regional struggle was now seen as a national movement. It was one of those moments when we had a glimpse, if but for a moment, of the truth. When Martin King spoke that day, many, no matter their race, realized that for all of us, our freedom is inextricably bound to one another's freedom. I cannot be set free until you have been set free. And that by its very nature, freedom is fundamentally relational. In King's words, words that we have come to know by heart at All Souls, that day it was made plain that we cannot walk alone. Indeed, last week, Kristen used the words of Brené Brown that we come to church not to receive an epidural, but to be partnered with a midwife. And this week in our gospel, what Jesus is reminding those gathered at the synagogue, remember, this is a reminder, not a new teaching. What Jesus is reminding us is that we are being set free in order that we might participate in the releasing of bondage, in the setting free of others. To that end, I ask each of us to open our hearts on this day, during this week, at this time. Open our eyes. Look well within. to the forces that bind us and those around us, preventing us from being able to stand up straight. Make no mistake, friends, these forces are insidious and they are legion. As many have noted this past week, this nation has changed a great deal in these past 50 years. But the promissory note that Martin King called upon is still outstanding. In a time when a black teenage young man in Oakland has an even chance of being college-bound or being shot to death, this note is still outstanding. In a time when the most vulnerable among us feel most closely the devastating effects of our abuses of this environment, this note is still outstanding. In a time when the crippling practices of unfettered capitalism bind the working poor so that the minimum wage is not a living wage, this note is still outstanding. In the investments that we make, in the goods that we buy, in the practices that we allow to persist, this note is still outstanding. It will take more than a touch to set us free from the burden that has many, many bent over. But it is from burden for all that my friend carries this bag everywhere she goes. For those two words remain as gospel truth. Be free.